This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Lynn Mark, and I'm here today with Philip Bowring, consultant editor of the Asia Sentinel, longtime contributor to publications, including the South China Morning Post, the International Herald Tribune, and the Wall Street Journal, and most recently, author of the book Empire of the Winds, The Global Role of Asia's Great Archipelago. Thank you for joining us, Philip. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me.
So first off, you've been an observer of politics in the region for over 30 years, and you've done extensive research into the history of Nusantara, so as you've said, the outer islands, from prehistory until modernity. So first off, I'd like your thoughts on how Malaysia's history as a trading nation has shaped the modern Malaysia.
Well, I think one must put Malaysia into the context of the whole archipelago and the peninsula, because I've endeavoured to look at these as one, because historically they have been, although they've been divided politically in very different ways from time to time, and divided to some extent by different religions. At the same time, they have a similar base, cultural base, language base, Austronesian languages, and a lot of cultural factors which date back to before the arrival even of Hinduism or Buddhism, let alone Islam or Christianity. So, you know, this is a region of where most people live on or near the sea, and where the sea and sailing and trading have always been crucial to the emergence and the consolidation of states. So Malaysia, you know, fits into that. Clearly, if you start from here, you start with the relationship between the peninsula and India, because it was from India that came merchants who brought Hinduism and then brought writing systems and other cultural features. But I mean, they didn't come en masse. So there was a cultural influence rather than a political one or any kind of immigration. So that kind of link across the peninsula was one of the original trade routes linking the East, I mean, i.e. China and other places, with India and hence with places to the West. So, you know, the peninsula has always been one of the most key aspects of the whole region, A, because of this original cross-peninsula trade route, and then a little bit later on, not much later on, and there was developed the route down the Malacca Straits and round to China and elsewhere in that way. But, of course, cross-border route remained quite important for a long time, because the sailing route, obviously, you know, it depends on the seasonal winds. So you can only go in one direction at half of the year. So the peninsula and hence the Malacca Straits were absolutely key to the whole history of this whole region.
Right. And so in more recent times, Malaysia has seen a shift away from trade towards slightly more service-oriented industries. But we made our first strides through our strategic location, straddling the sea lines of communication. But going forward, do you see us continuing to rely on maritime trade?
Well, I mean, the maritime trade is going to remain incredibly important. And the fact is that Malaysia is on the sea routes. I mean, you know, the Malacca Strait remains, you know, perhaps the world's most important single waterway. So you can't get away from that. Mm-hmm. Malaysia remains a relatively thinly populated country, considering its size, its land area, compared with Java, compared with China, compared with India, this is and will probably always be relatively thinly populated, as it always has been, because of the nature of the geography, the relatively small amount of flat land, which, you know, whether it's for rice growing or other agricultural uses. So yes, I mean, you can have further industrialization without any problem at all, but you're never, well, you're unlikely to have the density of population to, you know, compete with very large countries, except in niche areas. So those niche areas could well be, I mean, service industries or some type of manufacturing industry. But at the same time, they are going to have to involve continue engagement with the outside world, because the outside world comes past your doorstep.
And how do you see maritime trade in the age of the fourth industrial revolution? So one of the key themes in your book is that maritime trade is a key driver of prosperity in the region. But how will this contend with the rise of information trade? How relevant will physical ports remain?
Oh, well, very relevant, because, you know, there's a limited amount you can put into digital form. People still need goods. They still need to eat. They still need to move food around. One place can't produce everything, even if you industrialize the manufacture of food entirely. And, you know, people talk a lot about the China's Belt and Road and the going across Central Asia and so on. But, you know, transport by land is and will remain several times more expensive than transport by sea over any significant distance. So, again, come back to the point that these straits, and I'm not just talking about the Malacca Straits, because, you know, we must talk in regional terms. We got the Sunda Strait and Lombok Strait and the Luzon Strait. I mean, these are all part of this region, and they are all keys to international trade. Whatever, you know, politics, in whatever direction politics moves, that will remain the case.
You also write about a shared ethno-cultural identity between the countries and peoples of Southeast Asia. But how does this square with the modern post-colonial world? Has the identity of Nusantara been subsumed by an ASEAN identity, or is the ASEAN identity merely a facet of the wider region?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the ASEAN identity, I mean, people talk a lot about ASEAN, but there isn't really much popular awareness. I mean, it's an organization, it's does good, particularly in the field of trade liberalization and social contact and so on. I was certainly, you know, all in favor of ASEAN. I wouldn't want to decry it in any way, but it doesn't really resonate with the populace. And the fact is that when it comes down to other issues, whether it's language or culture or religion, you know, that there's huge differences, you know, between what I would call the mainland ASEAN countries and the maritime countries. And the maritime countries, as I said earlier, you know, do have this linguistic and ancient cultural link. And the fact is, too, that for 1,500 years, Malay was the lingua franca of this region, for traders at least. And, you know, I don't see why it shouldn't become so again. I mean, you know, Bahasa Indonesia is pretty much the same as Malay, and if you speak Tagalog or Visayan, you're not going to have much trouble learning Malay. So there is a natural affinity. If you go back, 130, 40 years to the early modern nationalism in this part of the world, who was the first champion of it? It was Jose Rizal. Who identified, you know, the Malay world and the need of the Malay world to re-establish itself, its identity, to get rid of colonial rule. And, unfortunately, as far as the Philippines got taken over by the U.S., so it sort of shifted its attention back across the Pacific. So the linkages that the Philippine part of the archipelago had with the rest of it became very weak after 1600 when the Spanish arrived. So, you know, that's a connection which needs to be strengthened again. And I noticed President Duterte was talking about possibly changing the name of the Philippines, from one which is derived from, a Spanish colonial king, to he used the term Malay word. So there is a consciousness, I think, just sort of sprouting that, with the influence of the U.S. In gradual decline, the greater sense of identity within this these three countries is necessary. I think, personally, it's about time that there's greater realization again of these links, and perhaps not only of between these countries, but the fact that if one carries on saying, oh, well, this one's Muslim and largely Muslim and this one's largely Christian, it's not going to work. Well, I'm sorry, we have to get away from identifying state with religion. Malaysia has a very large non-Muslim minorities, whether they are Bumiputra or not Bumiputra. Indonesia is a state which is very officially not Muslim, although 70% of the population are. So, I mean, here are examples of attempting to be broad in the sense of a national identity. So I think there are lessons from the immediate past to be learned as well as from the more distant past. If you look at the states in the region, the sultanates, which, let alone the earlier states, which thrived. I mean, Malacca was one and subsequently Makassar. These were places where, the rulers were religious people, or at least Muslim people, but they welcomed, people of all, faiths who, believed in trade and interaction. So there is a tradition in this region of tolerance. And it's a tolerance which, to some extent is based on the fact that they are, in the past, so trade dependent.
Okay, and on that note, I've been speaking to Philip Bowring, author of the book Empire of the Winds, The Global Role of Asia's Great Archipelago. We'll be back in just a few minutes with more discussion on China's position in the region. Stay tuned to BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, you're back on The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking to Philip Bowring, veteran journalist and author of the book Empire of the Winds, The Global Role of Asia's Great Archipelago. Earlier, we were speaking about Malaysia's position as a trading entity, as well as a Southeast Asian regional identity. But now let's turn the focus northward to China. So over the last decade or so, China has been gaining ground in its mission to reclaim its status as an economic powerhouse. What's your take on the current interactions between China and the states here in Southeast Asia? Are there any parallels we can draw here with history?
Well, China has always been an important market for regional goods and for goods from other parts of the world. Likewise, China has been a source of goods as well. Ceramics is the most noted. But if you look at China's history, foreign trade has never been exactly crucial. I mean, China is a large continental country where trade was almost very largely internal. So it didn't really need a great deal of foreign trade. And, what we've seen in the last 30 years has been, I suppose, fairly remarkable from a historical point of view, simply because it's unusual for China to get so engaged in the outside world. But and particularly after the period of under Mao Zedong, where it rejected too much engagement of the world to focus on China itself. But again, if you look at why did Deng Xiaoping's reform program required opening up to the world trade and so on, because China needed to learn. It needed to get investment. It needed to, modernization required foreigners of one sort or another. China has now reached a point, I suppose, where it's gradually going to become more self-dependent again. I would expect that the role of China, the role of trade for China, is actually probably just about at a peak in terms of its relevance to the whole Chinese economy. So, I think one needs to see China's present situation in this longer-term perspective, and also to see, to go back in time a bit and say, well, has this region always just, mainly dealt with China? And the answer, of course, is no, and probably trade with India was more important for long periods of time and may well be again. So, we've seen a huge change in the last 30 years, in terms of the role of China. And I'm not saying it's going to disappear, but just sort of looking at it from a rather longer historical point of view. Now, what China is doing at the moment seems to be, to some extent, somewhat counterproductive. On the one hand, it wants, close relations with the countries in the maritime region, and they obviously want investment and so on. But the fact is that you cannot have that and at the same time make sea claims which are simply unhistorical. And this actually goes back to a quote that I have from the Sultan of Makassar in about 1610, I think, or thereabouts, that God divided the land among men, the sea he gave in common. It's a very significant quote, from a small but state, which was then very engaged in international trade in all directions, with China, with the islands to the east, with Java, and with Mindanao, with the Europeans.
But it very much seems to me that China may not agree with that. And a side effect of your research is that it puts paid to the Chinese claims to hegemony in the region based on its nine dashed line. I take it you don't place much credence on their claims of historic rights to the South China Sea.
Well, no, I mean, I don't. This is not the intent of the book, but it's yes. A sort of side. It is a fact which emerges from the book because. Yes. Of the role of all these other players, who according to Chinese version of history, didn't really exist. They might have been there, but they weren't active. Which actually, the case is really the other way around for most of the last 2,000 years. So, that doesn't mean to say, of course, that the power does not supersede history. Maybe this is the new history. This is the present. But on the other hand, if we look back at, there have been two periods. One under when Kublai Khan was emperor, during the Mongol period, and second was in the early Ming period, which followed, of course, the Yuan, with the voyages of Zheng He. And Zheng He had this big fleet and sailed around and got various people to, states to offer, to send tribute to people, acknowledge the sovereignty of the emperor over them. It didn't last very long. The voyages. Seven voyages over 30 years, and then the whole thing came to an end. Why did it come to an end? Because, this Chinese, realized it's actually a waste of money. There was no threat in the Indian Ocean, And the gains from trade, as far as the state was concerned, were minimal.
Right.
So it was just a show of force, which was, you know, showing the flag, but really didn't address the security issues that China faced, which were on its northern and western borders. And, you know, historically, that has always been the case.
So countries in Southeast Asia, so Malaysia included, have been taking the issue of the South China Sea as an example. They've been reluctant to engage with China because it has maintained that they'll only negotiate the South China Sea in a bilateral fashion. In your opinion, would it be more beneficial to engage with China as a group, leveraging on our shared identity and experiences of the region, or has our somewhat checkered colonial history divided us from each other irreparably?
Well, I think, you know, the division in Southeast Asia is more between the maritime countries and the mainland ones. I mean, obviously, you know, the maritime countries, which are primarily, you know, Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines, you know, have a very specific direct interest in this sea issue. Myanmar has zero.
Practically
no. Laos has zero. Cambodia has only very marginal. So, you know, ASEAN believes in working on a consensus basis, and on this topic there is no consensus across the membership. In the Malaysian situation, obviously Malaysia has not yet faced quite the same degree of challenge that the Vietnamese and the Filipinos have faced The nine-dash line goes as close to, you know, the coast of Sabah as it does to the coast of Luzon. So the interests of the maritime countries are or should be seen as joint, whether or not, you know, the others go along with it. You know, ASEAN has been very successful in commercial terms, in trade liberalization, in social contacts, and so on. But, you know, its ability to be united on strategic issues or, you know, political issues is extremely limited. And, you know, it's always threatened by two things, I think. I mean, one is identification of religion with the state. And you can see that, you know, issues such as the treatment of Rohingya in Myanmar you know, creates antagonism in the Muslim world, even though you could say that the Rohingya issue is more of an ethnic issue than it is a religious issue, if you look at, you know, the past in Myanmar. At the same time, you also have, you know, the bits of former claims which still surface from time to time, and you know, for example, the Philippine claim to Sabah. I mean, frankly, it's you know, in my personal view, it's ridiculous, both from the historical point of view and from the fact that, you know, the Philippine state has been unable even to satisfactorily govern the Western Mindanao and Sulu, which are supposed to be the core of this claim to Sabah. So, you know, it's just disruptive. And you know, I would hope that they finally can, you know, see their way to, you know, abandoning it.
Thank you so much, Philip, for being on the show. It's been a real pleasure speaking to you. I've been speaking to Philip Bowring, author of the book Empire of the Winds, The Global Role of Asia's Great Archipelago, here on The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark for The Morning Run at BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, now with wider 4G LTE reach. Baru la bes.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.